Notes from the Left Forum in New York City. Rage Rebellion, Organizing Our Power was the theme of the conference. Chris Hedges, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author most recently of Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt, spoke at the Left Forum on May 20th, 2016. The plenary, Capitalism and Militarism, Organizing Our Power at Humanity's Peril.
Thank you very much. So when I came in, I was handed a broadsheet that pulled a quote, a half of a quote that I made. And so since I want to talk about the nature of power during this electoral campaign, I will finish the quote. I did indeed say it is not our job to take power, but it didn't end there. It is our job to make the powerful frightened of us. That is what movements do. Movements keep power in check. And as any good anarchists will tell you, power is always the problem, no matter who holds it. This is a realization that Karl Popper made in The Open Society and Its Enemies, where he wrote that it is not the job to get good people to rule. That, Popper says, is the wrong question. How do we get good people to rule? Rather, it is to create a system where those in power are frightened of us. Yes, we certainly want to push forward into power those who will listen, but without those movements, without the power of movements to keep the powerful in check, all power becomes despotic. And this was an understanding that Julia Benda had in his great book, The Treason of the Intellectuals, where he said that all of us who care to create a society based on justice, a society that takes care of the vulnerable and the weak among us, that expresses compassion, are given a choice between choosing two sets of ideals, privilege and power, or justice and truth. But as Benda writes, the more we make concessions to those who serve privilege and power, the more we diminish the capacity for justice and truth. And we just finished a session on Rosa Luxemburg, who I think of all revolutionary theorists probably understood this the best. It is important that we rebuild these movements now, movements that have been destroyed consciously in the name of anti-communism, especially at this crisis moment within the American political and economic system, where we are teetering on the brink of a very frightening form of proto-fascism. One of the mistakes that Bernie Sanders made, a mistake that Shama Sawant and I called him out on, before he announced his campaign, was the decision to run within the embrace of the Democratic Party. And we are now watching Bernie Sanders' supporters, and I think arguably Sanders himself, confront the fact that this has been a rigged system. That when you have a system, let's not forget, by the way, that the cost of running the primaries is paid for by the taxpayer. And yet, the primary rules are determined by the Democratic Party, so that they can manipulate a system as they did in Nevada to steal the vote from Sanders. They lock out independents. This is why in that last cycle, Sanders only won Rhode Island. That was the only state in which independents were allowed to vote. You have a system of superdelegates. You have money from super PACs. It's very clear that without all of these mechanisms, Sanders would win the nomination. And yet, through this long process, we have been given palpable evidence that democracy within the United States is a facade. And we are about to enter an electoral process with two presidential candidates who have the highest negativity ratings in American history, Donald Trump being number one and Hillary Clinton being number two. And those of us who care about recovering agency within our country, overthrowing the corporate coup d'etat that has taken place, and just for Homeland Security, who might be here tonight, let me repeat that word. That's called overthrow. We are going to have to step outside that system and build movements that resist. We are going to have to free ourselves from the insidious mantra of the least worst, because it doesn't work. Every election cycle, we're fed the mantra of the least worst, and it gets worse. Because our two-party duopoly, why it has a different rhetoric, serves the same centers of power. And that is why on all of the major structural issues, there has been complete continuity between George W. Bush and Barack Obama, with the caveat that Barack Obama's assault on civil liberties has been worse. And I speak as a plaintiff in a lawsuit that I brought against the president over Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act. This is a provision that overturns the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act that prohibits the military from carrying out domestic policing. And much to the chagrin of the Obama administration, we won in the Southern District Court of New York. And Judge Catherine B. Forrest, in a very lucid opinion, explaining her ruling, 112 pages, said that what this act does is empower the government to criminalize an entire category of people and detain them without due process, and she brought up the plight of the 110,000 Japanese Americans who were detained in World War II. Because this section authorizes the U.S. military on the streets of our cities to carry out extraordinary rendition against U.S. citizens, deny them due process if the state deems them to be a terrorist, and holds them indefinitely in our black sites, including our offshore penal colonies. And the two-year legal process, the Obama administration immediately appealed. They immediately appealed. The day of the ruling, they went into Judge Forrest's chambers, and they demanded that she lift her temporary injunction in the name of national security. And when the federal attorneys came in, they now came in with attorneys from the NSA. And Judge Forrest, to her credit, refused. That was on a Friday afternoon. At 9 a.m., they were in the Second Circuit or the Appellate Court of New York demanding the same thing, and unfortunately, the Second Circuit agreed. Why? The lawyers Bruce Affron and Carl Mayer and I wondered why. Why? We knew they'd appeal, but why were they so aggressive? And the only thing that we could surmise is because they are already using the law. There are already dual nationals, Pakistani-U.S. nationals, being held in black sites. And if they could get out, and if they could get legal representation, the government would be held in contempt of court. And what was the response? The Second Circuit, it's a panel of judges, they review the case, they wouldn't rule for months. And during that time, the lawyers went to Nancy Pelosi and they said, because this provision is renewed every year, all you have to do is insert into the provision that U.S. citizens are exempt. And of course they did not, because it was written for U.S. citizens. And so what does the Second Circuit do? It doesn't want to rule on the merits of the case because it's patently unconstitutional in the way that our evisceration of privacy is unconstitutional. And it essentially was another example of how the courts have become wholly owned subsidiaries of the corporate state and revoked constitutional rights by judicial fiat. What they did was wait for a Supreme Court ruling called Clapper versus Amnesty International. And I was a plaintiff in that ruling. This was challenging the government's wholesale surveillance before the Snowden revelations. And the federal attorneys got up, the government attorneys got up in the Supreme Court and said that I and the other plaintiffs did not have a right to bring the case because The idea that the government was watching us was speculation. And they added, if the government was watching us, they would tell us. So the Supreme Court, buying this argument, threw it out. And then the Second Circuit said, well, Hedges doesn't have standing in Clapper versus Amnesty International. Therefore, he doesn't have standing in Hedges versus Obama. Our cert, our petition to the Supreme Court, was turned down and it's law. This is all under Obama. It's Obama that's used the Espionage Act to destroy whistleblowers who once sought out independent journalists to expose corruption, malfeasance, and crimes against government. And here we must honor two of our greatest whistleblowers, Chelsea Manning and Julian Assange. And Edward Snowden. And if you don't have a third party option, then I would encourage you to just write in Chelsea Manning or Edward Snowden. Let me talk a little bit about what's coming. I think Sanders made a disastrous mistake. I understand his logic. When Sharma and I asked him, or you know, encouraged him to run as an independent, he answered, I don't want to end up like Ralph Nader. And what he really said is, I don't want to take on the Democratic Party establishment and become a political pariah. Because Sanders has played, I think, built a very Faustian bargain with the Democratic Party. He campaigned for Bill Clinton in 92. He campaigned for Clinton in 96, after NAFTA, after the destruction of our welfare system. And remember, under original welfare guidelines, 70% of the recipients were children. After the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill that exploded the system of mass incarceration that I want to address a little bit at the end. The deregulation of the FCC that turned the airwaves over to roughly a half dozen corporations. All of this was Clinton. In 2004, Sanders was calling on Nader to suspend his campaign. Sanders has always served as a kind of watchdog for the Democratic Party, and in return, they have not mounted a serious campaign to unseat him in Vermont, and he, in turn, has done everything he can to stymie third-party movements in Vermont. I think Sanders honestly believed that he had a chance. I think we are watching now a legitimate anger on the part of Sanders and those around him as they understand that the game was fixed from the beginning. And yet, I fear that Sanders will do what he says he's going to do, which is endorse the Democratic nominee. And at that moment, Sanders becomes an impediment to social change. If Bernie Sanders does not want to build a third-party movement, then we are going to have to build it without him. And we are going to have to free ourselves from this belief that we are going to make serious social change within the confines of a particular electoral cycle.
You're listening to journalist and author Chris Hedges addressing the Left Forum in New York City on the nature of power during this electoral campaign.
We are going to have to begin to organize and recognize that what we are building towards may be 10 years away. When Syriza began, it was polling 4%. By the time Syriza took power, it had a majority within Greece. We have to hold fast to that moral imperative. We have to stand up and be willing to defy the system. We have to step outside of the system. And the system will be ruthless in terms of its response. But we are reaching a moment, a convergence of deadly environmental degradation, breakdown. We're already watching it. Many of the refugees and migrants that are streaming into Europe, yes, there's war, but there's also tremendous drought in Syria. And this system is incapable of responding in a rational way to the degradation of the environment caused by the fossil fuel industry, and let me not forget the animal agriculture industry. Wall Street has been unleashed once again with money that has been given by the Fed at roughly 0% interest. And so at some point, we are going to see another financial crisis that may be twinned with an ecological crisis. And at that point of breakdown within a system that is incapable of responding except to further enrich and empower a global corporate elite, you will have large segments of the population, we are witnessing this at the moment in Europe, turning to these proto-fascist forces that are embodied in figures like Trump. Richard Rorty, in his book, Achieving Our Country, it was the last book he wrote, warned that the inability of self-identified liberal elites to respond to the suffering of the underclass, while it continued to speak in the language of diversity and multiculturalism, was actually empowering the nativist, racist, homophobic forces that are gathering around Trump. Why? Because they redefined empowerment. What did feminism become? Not empowering oppressed women, the way Andrea Dworkin called us to do, but by having a woman president or a woman CEO. And that lie, which was perpetuated by liberal elites, because the assault on people of color has been far more draconian than it has been on the white working class, allows demagogues like Trump to sell a message to dispossessed whites that they have been disadvantaged or disenfranchised because entitlements have been given to other marginalized groups. And the lie of our liberal elite has essentially come back, a kind of blowback against them. If Hillary Clinton becomes president, a figure, a political figure who embodies everything on each sides of the political spectrum we have come to detest, then you may get rid of Trump, but you will vomit up somebody even more vile. And the only way that we're going to be able to break the back of this rising proto-fascist movement tied to the gun culture and the Christian right is to build a viable left that holds fast to the moral imperative of defending the interests of working men and women in this country, and is willing to be pushed outside of power for a certain period of time, rather than dilute or give up that moral imperative, which is something, by the way, that Rosa Luxemburg understood. And it's we who have to do it. And if we don't do it, then we are going to see ourselves slide into a very frightening form of despotism, one where a state or a system of neoliberalism, which has lost all credibility, is forced to maintain power by carrying out increasingly more vicious and brutal forms of violence. This is something Hannah Arendt understood in Origins of Totalitarianism, when she wrote about the stateless, which is essentially what people of color in marginal communities are, stateless. They have no rights. They have been taken from them. Police serve as judge, jury, and executioner. And I teach, as you heard, in a prison. I just finished teaching Sheldon Wolin's great work, Politics and Vision, to my class. 94% of the people in our prison system never had a trial because the system is designed to deny them a trial. In fact, The students I teach who have the longest sentences went to trial, and they were punished for it because they stack charges against you, and then they barter like a poker game. But if you go to court, all of those charges are arrayed against you. And they have to give you a longer sentence because they use you as an example. They say, look, he went to trial or she went to trial. And that's the sentence they got, so you better take the sentence we're offering. You can understand the awful dynamics of the corporate state by looking at what it does to the most vulnerable among us, and the best place to do that is in a prison, where corporations have reached their deadly tentacles down to every facet of prison life. Global Tellink, which has taken over the phone services, and let's remember, the phone is the primary way that children remain in contact with their incarcerated parents, is 4 to 5 times higher than what we pay. Commissary has been privatized, and prices have ratcheted upwards. In New Jersey, you make $28 a month for 40 hours a week. It's neo-slavery. It's alive and well. And prices are now beyond reach. You are no longer given shoes. In the state of New Jersey, you have to spend $45 for a pair of Reeboks. If you send a money transfer through JPay, it's privatized. So you send $20, you get a $4.95 service fee. On and on and on. Fees are now imposed on you in prison. For instance, if you have a bereavement visit to someone who's dying, or you visit a member of the immediate family who's dead, in 15 minutes you get. You pay for the guards, the overtime. It's $900. So my students are getting out of prison thousands of dollars in debt. And when they get out of prison and thousands of dollars in debt, as ex-felons, they can't get jobs, one, because there aren't any jobs, and two, because they're demonized. And if they can't maintain those payments, they go right back into prison. And that's why that guy who got stopped for a taillight runs and is shot in the back. Some people say the system of mass incarceration doesn't work. No, no, they're wrong. It works just the way it's designed to work. It works because we have created, with the loss of our manufacturing base and the assault on our working class, a group of surplus labor who do not, their brown and black bodies do not generate an income for corporations until they are locked in cages where they can generate $40,000 or $50,000 a year. And the students I teach understand that reform is not going to come from state legislatures or from Congress. Because Corrections Corp of America and Global Tele, they've all got their lobbyists there writing the legislation. Go on Corrections Corp of America, the largest for-profit prison complex in the country, and on the website it says we are a good investment because there is 67% recidivism rate in the United States, which is why there are no programs, vocational, educational, any other programs. And they understand, as they have done, and I will close with this, that the only mechanism left is to carry out nationwide work stoppages within those prisons, because no prison can operate unless you have prison labor. And that is an example for all of us. They just carried one out in Alabama, in Georgia, on the anniversary of Attica on September 9th. They're organizing a nationwide prison stoppage. And as they have said over and over, don't go demonstrate in front of a courthouse. When we carry out that work stoppage, come to the parking lot of the prisons and stand with us. Let us all follow their example. Let us understand that if we mobilize and stand up and begin to disrupt this system, we can take power back into our own hands and eventually build in the years ahead towards the destruction of the corporate state. Thank you.
You've been listening to Notes from the Left Forum with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges. The program was produced by Linda Perry at WBAI News in New York, with thanks to Brian Drolet at Deep Dish TV and Seth Adler and Associates at the Left Forum. Thanks for listening.